get started for the day. We're happy to have Sakura Schaefer-Namecki here to tell us about non-invertible higher categorical symmetries. Okay.
Great. Thank you very much. Thanks to the organizers for this really nice workshop that they're putting together here and inviting me to speak. The talk will be about a paper that appeared in April and some work in progress with my postdoc, Lakshya Bhardwaj, student Lea Bottini, who's somewhere in the audience here, and economist matter theorist from Stockholm, Apoorv Tiwari. And we sort of set out to understand things that I think a lot of people here perhaps care about, which is generalizing symmetries beyond sort of the standard. Beyond the invertible sort of regime. So let me start with, in 2022, we're thinking about topological defects in quantum field theories as being generators of symmetries. And that is quite far from the 1918 version that Noether put forward. But it's actually conceptually very much the same philosophy. You have, in that instance of Noether, a point-like object charged under a global symmetry, say, and that you can think of as surrounding this local operator by a codimension one topological defect, and that measures the charge inside there. And for all the German speakers, she calls these symmetries of Lieschen type, which, if you speak German, is quite funny. Anyway, so if you don't, then I'll explain later. So since 1918, we've come a long way, and actually the progress really sort of took off these generalizations with this now classic paper by Gayota Kapustin Cyberg-Willen in 2014, where we say, well, we can generalize this notion to, for example, relaxing that this is now point-like object, we go to p-dimensional charge defects, and they're basically that charge is measured by topological codimension p plus one operators. So I always have this subscript of the d's. Is always the dimension of this topological operator, and there'll be some kind of label here, a group element of this topological operator. And in this case, G isn't some group gamma P, the P form symmetry group, and they obey fusion, which is group-like. So G times H gives GH, or this is just a group law. And usually gamma P in higher dimensions will be abelian, and very often for us it'll be a finite group. Then if you actually have multiple such higher form symmetries, you can say, well, do they actually just form product higher form symmetry groups? And that could be relaxed too, and that gets you to higher group symmetries. And in that case, you have, so for example, the option of, for example, combining the zero form symmetry with a one form symmetry or P form symmetry more generally. And those would then form what's called a two group. Now, the notion is a little bit more complicated. Let me just briefly summarize what it is. In terms of the background fields for this one-form symmetry, which is B2, the two-group just says the background for the one-form symmetry isn't closed, so delta B2 isn't zero, but it's given in terms of a pullback with respect to the bundle for the zero-form symmetry of some class, which is called this Posnikov class. So essentially, morally speaking, the backgrounds for the zero and the one-form symmetry cannot be chosen so independently. And you can, of course, generalize this to other p-form symmetries. Okay, in both of these instances, we've retained that these topological operators have fusion that are group-like. But we can relax that, and it gets us to the non-invertible symmetries. So if we relax the group law, we get to something that you could call fusion algebra. So now these topological operators, and I'll put some label I, we'll specify them later what they are, but they just fuse and give sums over topological operators. It's an algebra kind of thing. And of course, in two dimensions, if you ask over a two-dimensional CFT person, that's not news at all. These things existed for a very long time and are very well understood. Also in three dimensions. But then actually, if you go to higher dimensions, such symmetries are very new. So I think until a year ago, maybe there weren't any substantial examples in quantum field theories. And if you have now these kind of fusion type topological operators, and you have them in multiple dimension, then that gets you very quickly to this notion of higher categorical symmetry. So you get this collection from 0 to d minus 1 topological operators. They all have these complicated fusions, and you need to now formulate somehow consistency conditions between them. So that's basically where we'll be in this talk. Perhaps, I think, at least to me, the most surprising thing is this isn't sort of a thing that happens in very exotic quantum field theories that you have to construct in some elaborate string theory way, and it's something very, very remote. It really happens in vanilla 40-angle series. No supersymmetry, no matter, and we'll look at the examples of that. I think that's maybe something to keep in mind here. Okay, so we're interested in symmetries of QFTs. So the QFTs are,
Sorry. I understand that from a mathematical point of view, finiteness is easier to deal with, but is there any...
Finiteness of what? Finiteness of what?
Like in the fusion category, you have finite many things, but in like real theories, where does the finiteness come up?
Okay, so we'll ease it down a little bit. So I will tell you very you're preempting this slide. And I would love to talk about all the mathematical framework of it. I'll be very down to earth and look at a quantum field theory and construct these topological operators. And then I think it'd be very nice to actually discuss how what is the correct mathematical framework, right? Anyway, so what I'll actually consider is a QFT. So the QFT is a physical theory, it's not topological. Usually in dimension d greater or equal to 3, preferably d bigger than 3. And we'll have these topological operators of dimension p. They're labeled by some index I, and the subscript is the dimension of the topological operator. And the name of the game is, what are these guys in a given quantum field theory? What is their fusion? And of course, eventually, what do we learn from these things? What are the anomalies? And so on and so forth. So this is sort of preempting this question. Instead of developing a full mathematical framework, where we derive all the consistency conditions, we'll just implement this in quantum field theories and see what we kind of get. And then it would be very nice to develop this further. And of course, see this beautiful talk that we heard yesterday by David Reuter, who gave us sort of a more mathematical point of view on these higher fusion categories. In the last year, this has sort of been a huge enterprise. Lots of people have worked on this. We heard talks by Justin, Shu-Hang and David, and also there's a poster in a Gong Show by Leah. So I think there's a lot of activity. But let me now get actually to the plan. So I'll talk about symmetries from topological defects and higher categories. And this picture is, in some sense, I think, sort of giving you a sense of how this feels like if you go into these higher categories. It's a little bit like herding cats. They're like, you know, there's so many different, it's a very complex system. You very quickly see that you need to somehow organize this in a way that is made for physicists more accessible. And so I'll propose a way to construct such things using what I call gauging outer automorphisms. And that'll construct a class of such categories. And I'll give examples in 3D and 4D and maybe also in higher dimensions. And these fusions will be local fusions. And then I'll discuss also how this extends to global fusions. Okay, so how do we get these symmetry sort of categories from quantum field theory? So we start with a d-dimensional QFT, T, and we have topological operators, these topological defects. They will form what's called a d-1 category. So the objects are these d-1 dimensional topological defects. And then there are morphisms between them. So the one morphisms are d-2 dimensional objects. The two morphisms that are co-dimension 3, they're between the one morphisms, and so on and so forth until you get to local operators. So these topological operators can be genuine, so they exist sort of without reference to any other higher dimensional defect, or non-genuine operators, which actually live at the ends of other topological operators. So this is a good example to keep in mind. You have, this is a three-dimensional theory. They have a two-dimensional topological defect. Then there's a line at the end of it that's a non-genuine line. Then there's a local operator that's actually at the end of this line here. So there's a genuine line and a non-genuine local operator. So you can see this sort of is the structure. There are many complicated kind of ways that these can now interact. So the combination of all these objects, we call the symmetry category of the theory T. And of course, one interesting aspect of this is what is the fusion of these topological defects. So on the object, we have a fusion, which is if you take an object D1 and D2, then we can fuse to D1, 2. So we just take these two topological guys. This is all local. So you can think of this as a local patch, and you slam them together. And then you can get, so if you take two simple objects, you get something that could be simple or something that's not simple. So in the group-like case, this would just be basically the group product. So it would be another simple object, but generically, it's a sum over other objects. Now, between objects, we have morphisms, D1 morphisms. So if you have D1 and D2, there'll be some codimension 2 defect between them. That would be a one morphism between these two things. Now, we can compose these things. So for example, if you have D1, D2, D3, then we can take these two topological one morphisms and then compose them by just sort of collapsing this piece in the middle, and that would be composition. So these are sort of, I'm just giving you a run through of what the kind of structures are that we need, but I'll be very concrete in the actual QFTs that we'll discuss. This is just sort of to give you a flavor of how what kind of structures actually will come up in this whole discussion. So these topological defects can also have junctions, so you can have a junction between D1, D2, and D3, and I'll denote this by J, and so these are codimension 2 defects that live inside these three of these objects, and they're related to the morphisms by, for example, just slamming one of these onto the other, and then doing here the fusion, and then you get sort of again a morphism between the D1 tensor D2 to D3. Now morphisms, one morphism can also be composed. And so one composition actually comes very naturally from just taking this diagram and flipping it on the side and then saying this is actually sort of the fusion of these two one morphisms. But this sort of depends on this object D2. There's another way of thinking about a morphism that is sort of the fusion of these two D1, 2, D2, D3, 4. So let me just talk you through this picture. So we are trying to compute the sort of fusion of these two red lines. Now, these two can be constructed in the following way from this kind of junction picture. So if you cut this open, then you have here one junction and here another junction. And in fact, the fusion, when you collapse this cylinder here, this is then the morphism that's the fusion between these two, D1, 2, and D3, 4. So you see this becomes already quite elaborate. Now there are two morphisms between one morphisms, and then you can also look at fusion of two morphisms, and now you get sort of a sense of this becoming quite a complicated set of conditions. And right, all of these things also have to be consistent with, you know, associativity, etc. So rather than developing all this, we'll look at now, as I said at the beginning, a concrete quantum field theory setting where we can construct such, you know, categories and see what properties they have. And then, of course, it'd be very nice to put this into a more formal framework. Okay, so we'll look at QFTs, and there'll be constructions of non-invertible symmetries by gauging outer automorphisms, so zero-form symmetries. And the starting points will be very simple sort of theories. You should keep in mind examples are, for example, the spin for n Young-Mills theory, essentially in any dimension, and that has a Z2 outer automorphism that acts on the Dynkin diagram by flipping the two legs. And you can gauge the Z2, and that gives the pin plus for n theory. And actually, that will have these sort of higher categorical symmetries. Another example is that exists in any dimension is charge conjugation. So if U1, you can gauge charge conjugation to O2, or if for SUN, you can gauge to SUN tilde. And then finally, you have the S3 gauging, so that you can also do non-abelian gauging of Young-Mills series, so in this sort of setting, and that gives spin 8 with S3 gauged. So again, the outer automorphism that acts on the Dynkin diagram. Okay, so the example that, the first thing I'll explain is how to actually get from gauging such out automorphisms some new categorical structure. And the starting point will be sort of the category, not the full category that you have for a d-dimensional quantum field theory, but actually the one that's associated to the identity object. So we restrict to the co-dimension one guy that is the identity, and then look at all the topological defects that live inside there. This can be generalized, but this is sort of the one restriction that I'll put into this whole discussion. So G0 is this finite group, not necessarily abelian, and this is now the one that we'd like to gauge. And I'll start with a category at the beginning that is invertible. So it will be just something that has higher form symmetries that are all group-like. The example that will carry through the whole sort of talk is the spin for n Young Mills. So in three dimensions, for example, we have this outer automorphism, and then there are these two Z2 times Z2 one form symmetry factor. So it's Z2, I'll call one of these S, the other one C. And the Z2 here, the zero form symmetry, acts by exchanging these two one form symmetry factors. And the question is, what is now the category of that you get after gauging this outer automorphism? So before we actually can gauge this G0, we have to ask, is this sort of in physics terms anomaly free? And that in categorical terms means, is actually associated with G an algebra object? So let me just sort of summarize this briefly. It means, can we construct a collection of objects, which is just the sum of all the group elements of these topological operators and morphisms and two morphisms, et cetera. And then they have conditions to form what's called an algebra object if they satisfy associativity, pentagon identities, et cetera. So once you have satisfied this, what it means is you can then actually gauge the symmetry. And concretely, it means you can put basically defects for the associated with algebra object onto your space-time manifold. Yeah? Yep.
So imagine you gave this talk 30 or 40 years ago.
Yep.
No category, no generalized symmetries.
You didn't need any.
Wouldn't you just say that the spin, we can have a spin n gauge theory, and then we could just have another group? Would that be any different than that?
So it's true, you will have just a spin plus 4n gauge theory. But now the question is, what is the symmetry of the spin plus 4n gauge theory? So in the same, it's sort of asking, you might have not talked in...
No, my question is much more elementary.
Yeah.
So somebody gives you, in any number of dimensions, spin 4n gauge theory.
Yes.
And with or without matter, doesn't matter.
No matter.
In such a way that the other symmetries are preserved. And then you can just enlarge the gauge group by studying another gauge group where you gauge that symmetry.
Yes. And that's pin plus 4n.
That's?
Pin plus 4n.
Okay, wonderful. Yeah, we can study a pin plus 4n. Yeah. So we can study a pin plus 4n group. And the gauging is standard. We don't need the more sophisticated apparatus here.
So it's true, you can just study this gauge theory, but I don't know how many years you said, but 30 years ago, you might not have appreciated the one-form symmetries. So the question here is mainly what happens to this one-form symmetry that we have in this, right? If these are exchanged, right, you now have some other kind of symmetry. Obviously, you get sort of some invariant.
Won't it simply be the center of this new group?
Yeah, so but we'll get to it in a moment when I actually construct the symmetries.
Okay.
And then you'll see that there is a sense in which there's still some topological generator, so some symmetry that is like this diagonal of the center, but there's more. Right? It's sort of, you could think of it as like there's the invariant part, but then there's also in three dimensions, right, the first thing you note immediately is when I gauge a zero-form symmetry, you get a one-form symmetry. So now you have this one-form symmetry, and the question, sorry, you get lines, and now the question is how do these actually interact with this? So that's the question. How do you construct all these symmetries for the pin plus 4n gauge theory? Yeah, but that's absolutely how we would like to, it's really... That's just understanding in terms of gauge theory. Yeah, Dan?
Yeah. So the spin 4n theory has the symmetry of both gamma n and g naught. Is that right?
What is gamma n, g naught?
Gamma 1. The
gamma 1, yes. This is the one form symmetry. This
and
is
the g naught, yes.
No, g naught is z2, 0. That exchanges, that's just the outer automorphism. So the spin, our Lincoln diagram, right, and this is the outer automorphism. This is the z2, 0, and that's g naught. Then it has also a center symmetry. And the center
But that's an extension where the g naught's a quotient and the gamma 1 is the sub. So my question is, how can you gauge by the quotient group? I mean, it's not a subgroup.
Wait. So g naught is a zero form symmetry.
Yes.
And this here, gamma 1, is the one form symmetry.
I understand.
And now we have an action of one on the other. And I'm trying to gauge that symmetry.
Okay. Think more.
Yes.
Thanks.
So I will describe it now, and then maybe you can ask again. I'm maybe not understanding the question. Yes, Ibu?
There's a question online by Xu Heng.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose I take a lower dimensional decoupled TQFT that has absolutely nothing to do with the bulk QFT. This decoupled TQFT can be viewed as a trivial defect. Is it included in this category data?
This is the identity defect. Do you mean the identity defect? Yes, so I will construct
no.
A no? Okay, so what do you mean?
Can Yifeng, sorry, can Xu Heng unmute himself? Okay. I don't think people are allowed to unmute.
Hello. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Hi, Sakura. Yeah,
hi.
My question is that, you know, you take a decoupled TQFT of lower dimensions, so it's not a trivial defect. It acts trivially on all the observable in your bulk QFT, but by itself, it's not a trivial defect. It's just a decoupled TQFT.
Yes.
It could be, you know, spin 100 at level one transignment theory, for example.
Right. Why would I include
right.
That?
So it's not completely trivial. It's not an identity defect, but it acts trivially on everything in the bulk.
Yeah.
So
well,
I was
I
wondering
like
whether... Yeah. Whether that is included in the category data. I guess
no,
another way
I
to ask the question
yeah.
is that when we talk about defect in a fixed bulk quantum field theory, the space of defect is as wide, at least as wild as the lower dimensional quantum field theory or lower dimensional TQFT. So
mm-hmm.
I was wondering how that is included in this category formalism.
Right. So here I would like to have symmetries that act non-trivially on the QFT, right? So it's something like that you would maybe call it's the maximal thing that acts, but you know, non-trivially. So I'm not looking at the coupled sectors, right?
But,
so here, for example,
you can take an ordinary global symmetry in your
mm-hmm.
quantum field theory, say a Z2 symmetry that acts non-trivially on some of the observables, and then I just tensor product that Z2 symmetry defect with a decoupled TQFT, then the composite acts non-trivially, but it secretly carries a decoupled sector. So I guess
that
I was wondering, how do you mod out those ambiguity in this category formalism?
Okay, so this is sort of a minimality statement then, right? You would like to have, in a sense, minimal sort of topological defects that act non-trivially on the
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Oh, okay.
So So here in these quantum field theories, I think we know what are the symmetries that act non-trivially on the QFT. So I will start with these. It's a good question how you could sort of, you know, maybe enlarge them. But I think for these, this Z2-0 and the gamma 1, we have, we know that they do act. So I'm looking at
I have no problem with the specific examples. I was just curious
general,
about
is
the earlier
question.
Part of your general
absolutely.
Formalism. But yes, thank you.
Absolutely, yes. Thank you.
Question?
Okay, more questions.
So you have this statement about gauging this outer automorphisms. Can you say something what it does to the extended lines that are charged
under
this gamma 1?
Yeah, this is what I will discuss now. Yeah, absolutely. This is the whole point. Okay, yes. So it will, first of all, so this is just a picture how this G0 will act on defects. And in this case, the quota mentioned two defects. So essentially, this is sort of like a wall, and then you pass with one in, say, a line defect, and then it gets transformed into G times. And there's some action of this group. So in the case of the spin 4n, it will exchange the two generators of the Z21 form Z2 times Z21 form symmetry. So in this case, right, there's a topological line in 3D that generates Z2, this one factor here, Z2s, and there's another one, Z2c. They're topological lines. And what this G0, the Z2 does, is it just exchanges these two. And I want to gauge that. So we can gauge this in all dimensions. In three dimensions, in fact, this is something that is a standard categorical question because we're restricting to this identity component of the category. And then the zero form gauging was discussed in this set of beautiful papers by Bakeshli et al. And Fratkin et al. In Condensed Matter. And we'll take sort of inspiration from that and then generalize it to higher dimensions. So that's sort of the purpose of our paper. Okay, so let's actually discuss this in three dimensions first. So we have this zero form symmetry G, and it's implemented by this two-dimensional topological defect, or a set of topological defects, and we're looking at the category where we fix the three-dimensional, the rest of this category to be actually the identity. So D2 is sort of the component that we're looking at. So this is what I denote by C-id of the theory T. So now what are the objects that I get from projecting now or gauging this zero-form symmetry? There's, first of all, this is the answer to Nadi's question, right? So what kind of things do you get? So one of these obvious things I get is the lines now that are actually in representations of G. So they're just the duals to this gauged symmetry. And they form a subcategory of this gauged category, which is just the representations of G. Then there are yes?
Yeah, can I just have a quick question? So like the spin 4n theory, right, in any dimension, has this zero-form symmetry and the one-form symmetry. The reason why you're doing this in 3D is just because
you want to gauge. These lines will always be lines because they come from gauging the zero-form symmetry.
Okay, so my question is why three-dimension then?
Oh, I'm going through three dimensions because in this case there's a, because you have this whole machinery of MTCs and so on, you can apply to this. And in this paper, they have, sort of, you can check all consistency conditions as well. So in this case, it's extremely, it's a clean cut. There are no sort of guesses in this process. I will go to higher dimensions in a moment.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so one thing is we get topological lines, and that's general in any dimension. Then there are sort of the invariant lines. So these are just, you take orbits of this group action, and then we get lines that are sort of the invariant lines, the combinations of lines. Then there can be mixtures. So in fact, we can consider one of these objects that occur from these orbits, so they're labeled by some orbit O, and then there'll be a stabilizer, GO, of an element in this orbit, and then we can dress these defects with this with basically representation of this orbit. And I'll denote these by this. It'll become clear what exactly these are in this spin for an example. Obviously, if I have D1R, these ones here, I can just think of them as the identity orbit, because in that case, GOID is just G. Okay, so, and then there's a question of how do we fuse these lines. The lines that come from this web G, they're just fusing by taking D1R, D1R prime, to D1RR prime. So this is just the multiplication in the Pontryagin dual group of G. And then there'll be mixed fusions between these ones that are dressed by representations of the stabilizer groups and the ones that come from web G. And there we just essentially multiply the representations by basically projecting or mapping the this element S from G hat to the Pontryagin dual of the stabilizer. The interesting fusion comes when we actually take fusion of three of these mixed type of defects. In that case, a given in the fusion of, say, OR, O prime, and in this fusion on the left-hand side, there appears this one here if the dimension of this vector space, right, so in three dimensions, and this is actually one reason why three dimensions is very nice, because in this case, this is just the dimension of a vector space, and if this dimension is given by some number, then this is the multiplicity of diffusion of coefficient of this defect in the fusion of these two. So this is how we can determine fusion of this gauge category. Okay, let's go to this example. So a 3D spin for N Young Mills, we have this auto automorphism, we have the Z2 times Z2-1 form symmetry. So in the initial category, or the theory when we start has the following topological defects. There's an identity object, it's just a trivial defect, and then there's one that generates the Z2-1 form symmetry, the Z2-1 form symmetry C, and then to the diagonal, all denoted by D1B. So these are not all independent. And now the Z2-0 acts by exchange of D1S, D1C, and these two are invariant, right? So these will have non-trivial stabilizer groups. So by the rules that I just sort of outlined in this new category after we gauge, this is now the pin plus for engaged theory, we have the topological lines that are sort of just the duals to the Z2 that we gauged. I call this, there's a trivial line, and then there's the generator of this dual Z2, that's D1 minus. The orbit, well, there's the orbit, which comes from just this action here, the invariant combination, and that now in this new theory, in pin plus for n, that's now a simple object. And then there are these invariant ones. And then the third one, which was this thing where we dress things with representation of the stabilizers, the only one that's actually of interest is this D1V that has non-trivial stabilizer, and in fact we can just dress it with this D1 minus line. So in fact I'll denote this dressed line by D1V minus. The identity one already is basically this one here, the D1 minus. So the objects in the pin plus for n theory are now topological lines, which are identity, the D1 minus, this D1SC, V, and V minus. And now the question is, what's the fusion of these lines? So the ones that come from this gauged Z2 symmetry, they just obey standard Z2 fusions, the group-like fusions. And then there are these ones which are sort of mixing this D1 minus with these other defects. So those are kind of pretty straightforward. The interesting fusion appears with D1SC with itself and with D1V plus minus. And that's why we need to do these decompositions of this vector space and actually see what is the dimension of this vector space in this fusion. Okay, so let's actually look at, I'll do one example in detail and then the other ones I'll just report to you what actually the result is. So let's look at the D1SCV fusion. And if you remember in the spin theory, this was just the defect that came from the generator of the one form symmetry Z2S and Z2C. And then we now fuse it with D1V. And so that's using now in this original category, just the group-like fusion gives back that is actually D1SC. So, but that's not the category where we're interested in. We're actually interested in the thing after we gauge. So what can happen is, at most, in this fusion of D1SC and D1V, plus minus, you can get one D1SC. And the question is that coefficient actually non-trivial? And for that, we need to look at the morphisms, right? So the morphisms now tell us whether there's actually, in this gauge category, a non-trivial element on the right-hand side. So to see this, we have to actually look at, again, the theory before. So we would like to look at the fusion D1SC, D1, D2V, and D1SC. This should be D1 here, sorry about this. And now they're essentially in the category in spin for n, there are two types of morphisms that map between these objects that contribute to this morphism here. It's D1S, D1C into D1V, or D1C, D1S into D1V. And since S and C are exchanged, these two morphisms are exchanged under Z2. So as Z2 representations, they decompose into the trivial plus, the one plus and one minus. And so in fact, when we apply this now to this fusion up here, decomposes, we see both of these actually are present. So both in the D1V and D1V minus fusion, there's on the right-hand side one contribution of D1SC. So that's how this is sort of done in practice. Okay, so likewise, if you look at the diffusion of D1SC with itself, in the category of spin4n, this is two times D1H, two times D1V, but in fact, again, doing this decomposition in terms of the D2 representations, this actually is in the gauge category, just the sum of all the other ones. So 1, 1 minus, V, V minus. And this is now a category we've seen earlier already this week. This is actually of Tambari-Yamagami type for Z2 times Z2. So it has a fusion. Essentially, all these other lines here, they have sort of standard invertible fusion. And then there's one object, D1SC, which squares to the sum of all the others. So in fact, what you find here is if you go through all the movements of the Tambari-Yamagami, determining all these associators, then in fact, this category for this pin plus 4n is the rep D8 category. So this is sort of the result for if you look at now these topological lines, they fuse in this way. So there's still sort of a sense in which there's a D1V, D1V minus, these old topological objects that are invertible, but has one generally non-invertible line. Okay. Yes?
If I can make it there.
So when you gauge discrete symmetries, you typically have at least the possibility to add twisted sectors, no? Which
yes,
I think are important if you want to gauge back the dual symmetry to come back to the original theory. So why you're not adding the twisted sector?
Sorry?
Are you adding here the twisted sector?
So
why?
We have not considered twisted sectors. And you were just asking about how we gauge back?
Yeah.
Yes, so I have a comment about this. So in fact, if you do the same analysis for pin plus 4n plus 2, you also get rep D8. But in fact, there's a subtle difference. In fact, they differ by braiding. And so in fact, that allows you to distinguish the two. And then you can also go back again with this. But it's true, the twisted sectors is something that we should add in the future. Yes.
But so at this level, there is nothing charged with respect to the dual symmetry?
With respect to the dual symmetry?
The quantum symmetry arising after the gauging.
There's nothing charged on the dual symmetry. Under this symmetry here?
No, I mean, when you gauge like Z2,
yes,
you have the quantum symmetry, no?
Yes.
Which is D minus 2 from symmetry.
Yes. This is these are these lines D1 minus.
Yes.
So D1 minus generates a dual symmetry.
Yeah. But typically,
exactly.
The charged object for the dual symmetry are the twisted sectors,
yes,
no?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
And one other note, so this was the first note. The second note is we can now also gauge with this mechanism non-abelian symmetry. So for example, spin 8 with an outer S3 action. Okay, so this is the three-dimensional thing. And now Xu Wang was asking, why are you doing 3D? Well, in 3D, there are some things that simplify. One thing is that you get these nice sort of dimorphism spaces, just vector spaces. And so you just calculate dimensions of them. And we can generalize this now to higher dimensions. And so in D larger than 3, we have these symmetry categories again. They're not one categories, but now we really have higher categories. And again, I'll focus on this identity component. And so then we get D minus 2 categories for D-dimensional theory. So again, the objects are these codimensional 2 defects. These are the G-invariant combinations. And that actually percolates down for the P-morphisms until D minus 4. We always take just the G-invariant combinations of them. And then for the morphisms that are D minus 3 morphisms, which are the topological lines, in fact, we get contributions from all these three types that I was discussing in 3D. And of course, at the end, there are also the local operators, which are again computed. So these are the morphism spaces like we computed them in the 3D case. Okay, so in this way, we can now look at the four-dimensional, for example, spin4n theory. Again, we gauge this outer automorphism, and now the objects in this category are surfaces, again, identity S, C, and V. And now between each of these surfaces, there are now, each surface is invertible because we're looking at just the spin for engaged theory. There are no one morphisms between two distinct surfaces, but each of these surfaces has an identity morphism, and those I'll denote by D1 and then the label of the surface. So D1S is the topological line on this topological surface, and so on and so forth.
There's a question on one?
Yeah.
A question by Yifeng. How do you know that the duality defect have Frobenius Schur indicator 1?
The duality
example,
defect is
rep, rep D8, not rep PQ8.
This is in three dimensions.
Yeah.
This here, yes. So this here, how do we know this? We write down all these associators. You calculate the associators with this, you know, this special element SC, and you put this on all the diagonals of SC, and you do all these the Tambari Yamagami moves, and then it actually is really the D8. So this chi, I mean, if Yifan knows, so in this paper by Laksha and Yuji, they had this chi, which is chi plus, and I think tau is equal to plus 1/2.
Okay. Yifeng, if you want to comment more, you can unmute yourself.
So the answer to your question is you calculate it. Okay.
Can I make a quick comment related to Yifeng's question?
Yeah.
So when you gauge the Z2 zero-point symmetry in 2 plus 1D, you have options. There's a discrete torsion class in H3 of Z2, U1.
Yes.
So here I
absolutely,
assume you took the trivial.
Absolutely,
portion.
Yes. But this is a very interesting question. So this is the condition that I have put in. Do you see the slide? I think you see. The C it T, that it's the it component. This is basically saying we don't have any of this H2 of G, U1 turned on.
But no, but I was thinking about H3, not H2.
H3, okay. Mm-hmm.
And I think if you gauge with a non-trivial class in H3, then you probably get the other Tambara Yamagami.
I'm sure
you probably get rep of Q8.
Yeah, that's absolutely possible.
Okay, yeah, thank you.
But in this case, I'm 100% sure. It was a painful exercise that Leah, Laksha, Bhatt, and Purv and I did. Okay, so let's go to four dimensions, because this three-dimensional story, in some sense, is relatively well-developed. So let's look at the 4D theory. Again, all of these topological objects satisfy group law. That's our starting point. And now the Z2 outer automorphism acts, again, by exchanging S and C, both for the surfaces and the topological lines. And now the question is, so what is the set of objects we get in the gauged category? And in the surfaces, these are again just the orbits. So these are the invariant guys, so D2SCs, again, the sum of S and C surfaces, and there's D2V and the identity one. And then there's sort of the fusion of these guys is essentially just sort of D2SC. D2SC is 1 plus V. So the interesting thing is now in the one morphism, the endomorphisms of each of these surfaces, what happens to these? So we have in the set of topological lines, we now get the lines that are the duals to the Z2 that we gauged, as well as now again these twisted lines, the D1V minus lines from these stabilizers. And they actually satisfy again a fusion which is of this Tambari Yamagami type. Okay, now when I say this is just of Tambari Yamagami type, we're not in three dimensions, so you should ask me what exactly do you mean by this, because these lines really, they're sort of, you know, I was telling you these we should think of these lines, D1 minus, for example, and D1V and D1SC as so lines on a particular surface. So what actually does this fusion in this four-dimensional theory actually comprise? So right, so you should have said, hang on, actually, what exactly do you mean by this? So for example, let's look at this D1 minus that appears in the fusion of two lines on the SC surface. So what it means is essentially this picture. So we have a two-dimensional surface, and there's this D1 minus line that can end on it. And what the existence of this D1 minus in this fusion says is that there's actually sort of, you know, between this surface and this one this line, there's actually a non-zero local operator sitting here. And you can think of it as coming from the fusion of the two lines, the identity lines, one SC on the surface, D to SC. So this is sort of a point that in different papers people have dealt with differently. You could have also said, well, maybe we should think of this as two surfaces kind of fusing into a line. So you have a D to SC fused with itself, should contain this line D1 minus. But I think actually so the way it made that makes maybe this whole setup cleaner is to actually say we sort of do fusion in each dimension, so each dimension of the topological operators separately, and then in this case we interpret this as there are two non-genuine lines, D1SC, that live on the surface D2SC, and they can actually fuse to give this identity minus line, so D1 minus, that's a genuine line. So it sort of keeps the standard fusion philosophy that you fuse in a fixed dimension, but you now have sort of multiple layers of this. This is sort of just a comment for people who, you know, there's been lots of discussion about this kind of aspects. Okay, so I'm actually a little bit running out of time. We can gauge non-abelian symmetries. So for example, in three dimensions, following the same sort of strategy, we can gauge on spin 8 the permutation of the S, C, and V. So this is an S3 gauging, and then the category is rep A4. So here there's a slight step before. You can first gauge a Z3, then get rep A4, and then gauge another Z2, and that gives you then the fully gauged S3 category, that's rep S4. The interesting thing is we can also do this now in four dimensions. In this case, again, we do it in two steps. We gauge first a Z3 and then a Z2. The Z3 acts by exchanging S to C to V to S. So there's one invariant surface. So there's the identity surface and basically this surface here. And this is sort of the representation in the original category. And that's now a simple object in the gauged category. And the fusion of this surface with itself is just 1 plus itself. So this is a little bit like a Fibonacci. I think someone asked in one of the talks, is there a Fibonacci-like thing? So this, I think, is like a Fibonacci-type fusion. And then, in fact, there's sort of now on the endomorphism side, so the one endos on the surfaces, if we first gauge the Z3, we get the dual lines to the Z3, which are labeled by these roots of unity. Omega is just a third root of unity, so there's a D1 identity, D1 omega, omega squared, and the line on this SCV surface. And then in addition, now we gauge the Z2 to get a full S3 gauging, and that exchanges these two lines. And so we get essentially this picture here, where this is now again sort of a twisted version of the SCV line. And this is the fusion of all these lines. So this is nothing for you to sort of remember, but it's sort of telling you already that this can become quite elaborate. Okay, so let me, in the last sort of 10 minutes, talk about global fusion and then give you also some examples in higher dimensions. So far we discussed local fusion. So local fusion means I'm just taking sort of a local patch in my space-time and just doing this and without taking into account any global properties of the space-time MD. And we can lift this to global fusion. Essentially, in a nutshell, the global fusion of p-dimensional topological defects, D1 and D2, is obtained by gauging the symmetries that are localized on these defects. So for example, for this pin plus 4n and 4d, we had this fusion, D2SC, D2SC in 1 plus v. We have to gauge here, in addition, now the zero form, so Z2 zero form symmetry on each of these defects. And that's basically the global fusion. We're now M2, so it says there's a two-manifold inside M in the four-dimensional space-time, and the global fusion is now done on this two-dimensional manifold M2. And in fact, what these guys are essentially exactly these condensation defects that we heard about before. We proposed these fusions in higher dimensions, but it would be actually nice to check this against an alternative framework. And in the case of this pin 4n plus theory, there's an alternative way of getting the fusion of these topological defects, and that's using this approach by Kai Diomori and Zeng, and also very similar and related Choi Cordova Lam and Chow, where the approach is somewhat slightly different. And the one I'll actually focus on is this mixed anomaly approach. So the pin plus for n we can also obtain in the following way. So if we start with a spin for n, we said we just gauge the Z2 outer automorphism to go to pin plus for n. You could also first actually gauge just one of the one-form symmetries and go to the SO gauge theory. And the SO gauge theory actually has a mixed anomaly. So here A1 is the zero-form background, so this is the Z2 zero-form symmetry. And then C2 and B2 are backgrounds for one-form symmetries. And this comes from the fact that actually the spin has a two-group, which is the variation of the B2 one-form symmetry background is A1, C2. And so that sort of indicates this Z2 symmetry that we have. So the SO4N has this mixed anomaly, and now in this mixed anomaly formulation, we can apply this KOZ approach and gauge now A1 and B2 prime, which effectively amounts to just gauging A1 starting with spin 4N. And applying this, we get the non-invertible surfaces in this pin plus 4N. And so if you apply this sort of to the mixed anomaly, this KOZ approach, what you find actually is exactly this kind of fusion. So here these are the surfaces. I'll give you the translation in a moment. So you get these non-invertible kind of fusions for these surfaces N2, N of M2, which are coupled to this background C2. And then there's also this condensation part that depends on the lines. And so the dictionary here is that these n's are precisely the D2SCs, and the D2M that appear on the right-hand side is just the V, and then there's, of course, also the identity object that's just written as 1. So in this sense, these two approaches give the same thing, so it's kind of reassuring. Okay, finally, let me actually get to sort of an example of a higher-dimensional theory. You could also apply this to 5D, 6D, CFTs. Here, let's just in the same realm.
There's a question online yes? before you move forward by Shu Hang. Is your local fusion the same as the fusion modulo condensation in David's talk yesterday?
Yeah, I think so. We had a discussion about this yesterday, and it really seems this equivalence class that he was talking about. I should probably look there. The equivalence class actually is precisely sort of taking out this condensation by all the lower dimensional ones. So you would still, right, this fusion that we have here, I think, seems to be precisely keeping everything modulo condensation. That's my understanding of David's point. Is David here? If he is, he should correct me if I'm wrong. Okay. Okay, so in 5D, again, we can look at the spin for n theory, and then we have a three categorical symmetry. You can run the whole machinery again, and you get again sort of in the surfaces and the three manifolds, the standard fusion that I've now shown you several times, and that will just, I think, in higher dimensions percolate through, and the interesting stuff is again happening in the lines where we get this Tambari-Yamagami type fusion. And then again, there's a non-trivial global fusion for these three manifolds, where we now have to gauge a one-form symmetry on each of these defects. And that's, so the one-form symmetry is being generated by these topological lines that live on these three manifolds. Okay, so let me actually comment and then conclude. So we only, I think, started to dip our toes into these higher categorical symmetries in QFTs. And here we looked at the 3D and 4D examples mostly. There are many other applications or many other instances where this can be applied. These O2 gauge theories that appeared initially in this paper here, we can derive these fusions by gauging against our charge conjugation in these theories, and similarly for SU and tilde. One thing that this approach I was talking about allows you to do is gauging non-abelian symmetries. I'm not sure this is possible in these mixed anomaly type or duality defect type approaches, so it would be interesting to see whether the other ways of checking these fusion rules. There are also non-invertible categorical symmetries of supersymmetric theories, 5D and 6D theories. So for example, you can look at an absolute 6D 2,0 theory. So that's of with gauge algebra, gauge group SO plus SO, and then gauge sort of the exchange of these. And there are also non-invertible symmetries in 5D. So that's not very surprising because there are lots of these mixed anomalies that I think we heard about in Iñaki and Federico's talk. And so you can use these to generate non-invertibles as well. Okay, some outlook. I think really what would be nice is to get some more handle on the mathematical framework for all these categorical structures in high dimensions. I've gauged now really always the zero form symmetry. It would be nice to also learn how to do gaugings of higher form symmetries, like one form symmetries in these categories. And then I think the most interesting points, of course, can we actually learn something about these symmetries? So like in Shuhang's talk, actually get some interesting physics out of it. And one question is, of course, also sort of obvious, is this now the actual structure that's the most general structure for symmetries in quantum field theories, or is there some other layer that we should be adding to this whole story? And then finally, what are actually these realizations, particularly if you're looking at superconformal field theories in higher dimensions of such non-invertibles, and that there probably there's a way to think about this using the SIM TFT. Okay, so thanks very much. Other questions?
Thank you for the very nice talk. Any questions?
Okay, so I think like this gauging of a discrete group also acts on line operators which are not topological, no? In the same way, essentially,
yeah.
Right, with some lines and so on. So can you learn also something about the spectrum of these operators in the gauge theory? Maybe that's interesting.
So really interesting questions, of course. What actually happens to the charged objects under this, right? So now you have this category. Now we finally constructed the generator, so to speak, of our symmetry. Now what do they actually charge? What are the objects?
Because it's not a group, like it's not a gauge group anymore. So I don't know to label the line operators.
That's a really great question. It's something we've been discussing also with Andrea here. Yeah.
Any other questions?
Maybe from online? Nope, they're all happy.
Okay, so maybe thank the speaker again.
Thank you.